Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks. And for this episode, I thought we'd start by looking at ideologies, which for many people is kind of new, a new concept in the politics A-level, where you look at the core ideologies of liberalism, conservatism and socialism, as well as a number of optional ideologies. And I thought what we'd start with is a brief look at liberalism, and then focusing on one of the key thinkers, because to really get to grips with an ideology, you really need to start with the thinkers, what they were writing about, and think about the context of the time in which they were writing. So hopefully by spending a bit of time looking at John Locke, I'll give you a good understanding about his ideas, his motivations, and why he came up with the liberal philosophy that he did. So let's start with a general look at what liberalism is, trying to get to grips with it. Well, it's complicated, it's intricate, and it's often a very misunderstood ideology. Just ask anyone who deals with American politics, dealing with liberals and conservatives and what all that means. In many ways, liberalism marked the beginning of political ideologies in the Age of Reason. So it was the liberal thinkers like Locke that really got this whole idea of political ideologies and political reasoning going in the first place. What we commonly regard as liberalism came about really in the middle of the 19th century under people like John Stuart Mill. But the ideas and concepts that influenced them came into existence long before then. And arguably, liberalism had reached its great peak during the French Revolution. Understanding liberalism is also complicated because it spills over into other ideologies. So you have liberal forms of feminism and liberal nationalism, liberal socialism. You can even have a liberal conservative. And then you get into the neoliberals and sort of the libertarian views, and it all gets a bit mixed up. And what exactly is it that we mean by liberalism? One of the central disagreements that exists is whether liberalism offers a corrupt picture of human nature, society and politics, saying that it's all bad and needs to be sorted out, or a basically sound ethical vision that needs liberating from the socially limited expression of it offered by particular liberals, be that patriarchy for feminists, the capitalist state for socialists, or excessive faith in the state as a means of achieving social justice for libertarians. So what is liberalism? Well, the key to understanding it, as it is with all ideologies, is to understand the political context in which thinkers were writing. Liberalism is a product of its time, and as it has evolved and morphed into new versions, it has responded to changing threats and political cultures. Liberalism is also a nationalistic product, as different nations have evolved different ideas and concepts of liberalism to suit their own ideas and their own needs. For example, the proto-liberal John Locke was writing in an era after the English Civil War, when the world had been turned upside down and shattered by the forces of the state, either monarchical or parliamentarian. And he was writing at a time when, or in exile, during the glorious, just before the Glorious Revolution, when he had been a victim of the despotism or tyranny, if you like, of James II. And Locke was trying to make sense of the world and to give a justification for his actions and the people that he worked with. And in this, he suggested that state power was the greatest threat to human happiness. Well, more modern liberals were writing at a time when socialism was on the rise and unfettered capitalism had led to huge inequalities in society. And these were seen as damaging for all concerned. Therefore, modern liberals like Rawls saw the state as a means of securing individual happiness rather than a threat to it. Liberalism in England took a different form from that in France, in Germany, America or Russia, and as such, context is key to understanding it. While most liberals would agree with the view that individual liberty is the highest political value, is this liberty a positive, which is protected by the state, or a negative, with no involvement from the state? What are the limits on liberty? Does a liberty, like free speech, become a fundamental right to say anything you like, regardless of truth or consequences? Or can it be limited in such a way as to protect others from harm, bringing in the idea of the harm principle? Is a person's liberty constrained only by physical restraint, or by threats, or by social disapproval, or by any other means? These are all good philosophical questions to ask and consider. Now, there are, of course, some key agreements amongst liberals. However differently these core similarities are interpreted by different liberals in different settings. For nearly all liberals, the individual is the central unit of ethical value, and the protection and promotion of individual interests are the key principles of liberalism. Above all, liberals agree on the primacy of individual freedom as a means of protecting individual liberty and securing the greatest happiness. This sets liberals against tyranny and arbitrary absolutist government, which suppresses individual freedom. And to understand liberalism, you need to think about the context in which classical liberals were writing. Now, John Locke will be the first one that we'll look at. And we need to remember, yes, he's writing, most of his works were written, or published at least, in the late 1680s, 1690s. And this is in the wake of the English Civil War and the abuses of power committed by Charles I and then Oliver Cromwell, followed in turn by the abuses of power of the Restoration monarchy and fears about the arrival of William of Orange. John Locke himself had to live in exile for a number of years in the Netherlands because of his association with the Earl of Shaftesbury, who had become a rival and a great critic of the then King James II. So Locke had nothing but negative experiences of the idea of absolute monarchical power and had been himself a victim of it. So Locke was trying to find a way of restricting the power of despots and ensuring that the rights of individuals would be protected. His major work on this was his two treatises, and this was published around 1688, about the same time as the Glorious Revolution and then the following passage of the Bill of Rights in England. Both of these were attempts to remove a despotic monarchy and to restrict the power of a potential future despot. Locke argued that the state, or any political society, is the product of the people, and therefore there must be an active consent from the governed. A government rules with the consent of the governed. That is the fundamental principle that Locke came up with. Since humans are naturally free, they can only give up their freedom by agreeing to forego their natural liberty and placing themselves under the control of a political authority, the government. This, in a sense, is a choice the people make. In this sense, Locke sees there being a contract between the government and the governed, whereby the governed give up some of their freedoms on the basis that the government allows them freedom and protection from external threats. Locke suggests that this consent only needs to be tacit, in the sense that they don't openly revolt against the government of the day for every minor indiscretion or mistake that the government makes. This leaves the government free to judge and enforce what Locke would term God-given natural laws that humans like to follow. For Locke, the legitimacy of the government depends on it legally enforcing the laws of nature and protecting the, quote, life, liberty and estates of those who are subject to the government. Locke suggests that when the government fails to protect the natural laws of life, liberty and estates, the political bond between the government and the governed should be dissolved, and the people have a right to appeal to heaven and to resist and replace their government. While the people are the final judges of whether the government has become tyrannical and broken the contract with the governed, Locke strongly asserts that relatively minor misdemeanours should be overlooked and that revolutions should only aim to re-establish the political bond and restore a prior set of constitutional arrangements between the government and the governed. To put it another way, minor things should be ignored. But Locke would argue that if a monarch or a ruler betrays the people and fails in its duty, there is a right for the people to rise up in rebellion and remove them. Now, this is pretty much a treasonous work in many ways. He's justifying the overthrow of monarchy, and lots of monarchs aren't keen on that idea. But it was a justification for the actions of the Glorious Revolution. And for that reason, Locke actually published his two treatises anonymously at first, because it was a huge risk to justify a revolution against the established order. But Locke thought it was justified if the government failed in its duties. So remember, Locke was writing this at the time of the Glorious Revolution, when the English rose up against King James II and overthrew him for what were seen as serious offences and failures to protect the life, liberty and estates of the people. In inviting a new monarch in the form of William of Orange, Locke and his contemporaries were not attempting to overthrow the political system in the UK as such, but simply to remove a governor, King James II, who had failed in his duties, and to replace him with a more appropriate governor who would be better at upholding the natural laws and protecting individual liberties. In order to ensure this, a Bill of Rights was introduced to limit the power of future monarchs and prevent another failure. In many ways, Locke was justifying the actions taken by the English political figures in 1688, but his words were gone to have a tremendous effect on the American War of Independence, where Jefferson's declaration borrowed heavily from Locke's two treatises, as it described the self-evident truths that all men are created equal in pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. Happiness meaning the right to independence guaranteed by the ownership of property or estate. It's basically taken straight from Locke. And in Jefferson's case, he argued that as George III had failed to protect the American colonies, and the colonists, and had failed in his duties by the imposition of taxes and threat of military force, it was the duty of the colonists to rise up and remove him as their overlord and replace him with something better. In that sense, the Declaration of Independence couldn't have been used and couldn't have been a rallying cry to the colonists without Locke's previous justification during the Glorious Revolution. Similar justifications were used in 1789, when the French overthrew their king, who was seen as failing in his duty to protect the life, liberty and estates of the French people, and why the rallying cry of the revolution would be liberty, equality and fraternity, all of these central ideas of Locke's political philosophy. Now, Locke would not have regarded himself as a liberal as we would know the term, mainly because the term doesn't become used commonly until much later in the 19th century. But his views on the primacy of the individual and individual freedoms, based on a positive view of human nature that saw man as achieving his best when he was free to pursue his own interests, deeply affected the development of liberalism. Locke's view of the state probably had an even more profound effect on the idea of liberalism and the politics of the later half of the 18th century, as peoples began to rise up and replace governments who had failed in their duties to protect such natural laws. And, as such, Locke's theories played a key role in the development of liberal nationalism and the concept of the nation-state, which would be echoed by Rousseau. Indeed, Locke also had a huge impact on Mary Wollstonecraft, who not only would become a key liberal thinker in her own right, but also effectively come up with the early theories of feminist of the feminist movement. So for Locke, the best way of securing individual happiness was for individuals to own private property. Locke was not quite a supporter of free trade capitalism as we might know it today, and he certainly saw private property as a gift from God, with it only being right that those with more ability and talent should own land and property. So he wasn't quite all for everyone owning property. He did feel, you know, it was only if you deserved it and it was a gift of God in his view. However, he believed that private ownership of property would lead to better economic management, and that in turn would lead to a greater economy, which would create greater happiness for all. Above all, for Locke, private property was seen as a protection against tyrannical governments, as it would provide a means of independent wealth and security against the demands of an overpowerful state. For Locke, an Englishman's home would be his castle because it would protect him from the armies of a despotic ruler. And in that theory, we can essentially see the British Bill of Rights. We can also see many of the American Bill of Rights being justified by that theory. So the impact of Locke's writings and ideas cannot be underestimated, and he laid the foundations of modern liberalism. But he didn't create the fully formed version of liberalism. That would come from John Stuart Mill, but only after the central ideas of Locke had been tested and then, in France, seemingly failed. A number of thinkers writing in the immediate aftermath of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars tried to reevaluate and develop Locke's ideas to explain the failures of the French Revolution and to provide a practical solution to future problems as thinkers in Europe and especially Britain began to make sense of the new world of growing capitalism and economic prosperity, while there was a growing reaction against Locke's liberal ideas taken in the form of a conservative ideology which had been terrified by the excesses of the French Revolution and sought to maintain a higher degree of order and tradition. Edmund Burke would be one of the thinkers that moved from the liberal to the conservative view. But there were three thinkers, Benjamin Constant, William von Humboldt and James Mill, father of John Stuart Mill, who would remain to develop key ideas about liberalism and uphold liberalism despite the problems caused by the French Revolution. And these three key thinkers would go on to achieve a more fully rounded form under James Mill's son, John Stuart Mill. But that is for another time. So I hope that's given you some useful ideas and an understanding about John Locke and the original concept of liberalism as he understood it. The context is key, and from this you can draw similarities with the other key thinkers, but you can also see key differences and be able to explain those differences, because Locke was writing with a very different purpose at a very different time from some of the later liberals that you might come across. I'll come back to liberalism and liberal thinkers at some point in the future, but for now, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen to a future podcast. I need to find a better way of ending these, because I never know how to do it. Maybe I'll just give a noise or something. Anyway, speak to you again soon. Waha!